Go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join the madness.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
Welcome, welcome to day number 2 of the Gail Carriger co-hosted spectacular celebrating the 1,000th episode of The Everyday Novelist. Today is actually the 1,001th, 1,001st, 1,001st episode of The Everyday Novelist, and multiple New York Times best-selling author Gail Carriger is here with me again to answer a question from Art, who asks,
I've heard it said, don't borrow, steal, and when you do, steal from the best. Is this something that can be applied to make effective art? If so, how? At what point does doing this become at least a derivative and, at worst, plagiarism?
Oh, this is one of those really great questions that's really hard to answer with language.
Yes. So I'm going to go with something for which I am familiar, which is style. It's very different to do a knockoff Chanel bag that is completely derivative than it is to look at a celebrity, for example, who dresses in Chanel and attempts to imitate their general style. So those are like, that's the nuances that we're into here. So the plagiarist actually steals the prose of another author. Whereas the idea is, I'm sure there's a good quote out there from somebody who said, what you want to do is a deep dive into what is working stylistically for an author who you admire. How they're executing many of the tricks and tips that Dan has talked about on this podcast over many, many years. What is their sentence structure like? How do they handle action, description, dialogue, that sort of thing? And like, and not copying it, but figuring out why it's working and how you might adapt that to your own voice. Now, for me, this is humor. I write funny stuff, or at least I try to, and that means that I am constantly analyzing humor. So I watch stand-up comedy all the time. Like when I laugh when I'm reading a book, I go back and try and figure out why it made me laugh. The same thing with movies and television. And that's just because I'm in a constant state to be like, oh, why did I find that funny? Like, what's funny about it?
Glad I'm not the only one that
does this. And this is just to be like, how can I stick this into my universe? How can I twist this to be something that is funny to a bunch of gay werewolf shifters, right? Like, you know. And sometimes it's non-transferable. Sometimes it's a political joke that requires so much current knowledge about life and our situation. But that also is interesting to think about. Like, oh, so this is a context joke, so I would have to have set up all of this context and all of this history for a joke similarly to occur within the context of my universe. And I think you can do
that. But
that
does reveal
writing.
The underlying principle of the mechanics on which it turns, though.
Precisely. So I guess, like, the short answer to this question is what you have to do is and this is rough because it makes it hard, for example, for someone like me and Dan to find things funny anymore because the analytical part of our brain is always there. But to tailor that analytical part of your brain, to start to think about, like, not how can I write the same thing, but why is this working for this author's voice? And how do I write in a way that would make something similar work for my voice?
You know, I've talked a lot about crossing the line twice, that humor technique that Monty Python uses. And what I've found is that when I'm wanting to internalize mechanics of something I'm wanting to get my head around, I'll do a lot of that. Something will catch my attention and I'll just hammer it and hammer it and hammer it until it's totally boring, and then keep hammering it till it's funny again, or interesting, or whatever it is that caught me. But one of the things about doing that, aside from it being really effective, is I've discovered it solved that problem, at least for me, of approaching things from a default cynical position. Like, when I was learning filmmaking, I had that problem in spades. I could not watch a movie without taking it apart. I couldn't enjoy anything. I couldn't enjoy anything until after I'd dissected it. And when I got into studying humor, that approach killed it. I couldn't find anything funny. And
yes, I think stand-up comics have that problem when they're watching other stand-up comics. They... They talk about that.
But once I started deliberately crossing the line twice with things, I found that it took the burden of analyzing things off of my initial encounters. Because I knew that if I liked it, I could figure out what it was that I liked. And somehow that's brought me back to a place where I can watch anything with almost a naive set of eyes. And then afterwards, go back and take it apart. And one of the weird things it's led to is, like, for example, I enjoyed Avatar the first time I saw it, even though as I was walking out of the theater, I was thinking, God, that was utter shit. But because I went in with the first naive set of eyes, I enjoyed the experience, even though I'm never going to watch it again because, oh my God, what a terrible movie.
I totally get what you're talking about. And it does... It took me a little while to get it, and there are certain instances where I still can't turn off that analyzer in my brain. I call it the bleeding editorial eye. There's this, like...
That's a great term.
The brain that you put on as an author when you switch from producing content to editing your own content is a different kind of brain, right? You put on the editor brain, and sometimes that editor brain interfaces with other forms of media for me and never is off. And, like, when I'm reading, it's that editor brain in terms of, like, typos, for example.
Oh, that's the
real...
It's still bad for me there,
too. Yeah, like, if there's just too many typos in a book, even if I'm enjoying it, I can't keep going with it. I just have to turn it off. Which makes it, when a book really grabs my attention and totally immerses me, like, I emerge from that experience being like, oh, I haven't had that kind of experience in a while. But that said, there are certainly some genres that I just turn, I can switch that switch off. And in reading, and it's more likely these days to happen with television or film. But I had a similar experience recently where I watched this sort of Chinese college set melodrama romance, which, because it's from China, it violates certain core principles of my dearly held self in terms of feminism and queer rights, for example. And yet it was so addictive, and I can't figure out why. And I've actually thought about going back and re-watching it, trying to figure out what it is about the style, particularly of how they wrote this sort of slow burn romance, that I found so addicting, even though it's not meant for me, right? I am not the target demographic in any way. I am too old. I am too white. I am too American, right? Like, it wasn't meant for me, and yet it worked on me. Why? That's very interesting. must go in and figure this out. But it is... It is a subtle distinction to try to make, to realize that we have these kind of different brains that as artists or as writers we bring to our consumption of content, and how, when content really appeals, how we then analyze that content in a way that allows us to make use of the parts of it and understand why those parts worked.
I'll tell you the one thing that does it for me reliably, no matter how much I try, is voice, because I cut my teeth in audio. If the character voice or the narrative voice jumps all over the place, I go nuts.
You don't like it.
Contrary-wise.
If it's strong.
No, not if it's strong, but if it's inconsistent.
Mm-mm. Yes, yes. Yeah.
Contrary-wise, if the voice control in anything is really consistent, even if it's the kind of story I hate, or it's got a cultural perspective I think is bullshit or whatnot, I will stick around for the voice because that is music to the deepest part of my soul.
I so agree with you. There's a handful of authors, and I think every reader has this, and I think most authors have it too, which are your auto-buy authors.
Yes.
In other words, I will buy anything that they write. And most of the time for me, in fact, I cannot come up with off the top of my head a time when this is, it's because I love their voice. And, like, it's not a voice that I can imitate or in some cases would want to imitate. I mean, I have this gay romance author I love named Mary Calmes. And, like, she breaks so many things. Like, she breaks so many kind of basic rules of grammar and, like, other things that I don't like. Her stuff is full of tropes that ordinarily I would not enjoy. And yet there's something about her voice, like the sort of casual, breezy humor voice that she brings to everything she writes, that I'm like, well, I guess I'm reading this. There's nothing I can do about that. And yeah, and I think that the voice is the thing that as creatives we hunt for, because if we have a strong voice, which our reader base is particularly attracted to, that is how you get readers who are like, I want to read everything that you've written, and I don't care where you go, I'm gonna follow you. Which, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have a, you know, a good core fan base who feel that way about me and have followed me into some very peculiar places that I have gone. And I've been joking recently that with a nonfiction book coming out, we're gonna see if, like, we're gonna see how far that stretches. But yeah, because that's your career, right? Readers who read you are your career.
Believe it or not, I don't think that's going to be as much of a problem as I think you think it is.
I know.
Because I've read it. And you're a voicey writer regardless of what you're writing.
Yes.
And your voice is still there. All the way down to the weird turns of phrase you make and everything.
It's true. It is. But it's an out of context subject. So, you know, like, who knows what's going to happen. But yeah, like I said, I think if you can get your voice and you can get it good and be real confident in it, like that's how you have a career, especially as a wide author, as a non-to-market writer, as somebody who wants to be able to play and experiment widely in different genres, subgenres, etc. Like
you gotta have a strong voice.
It's gotta be voice. Yeah, that's what's gonna keep your readers. And let me tell you. They don't know that. Like, readers don't understand voice at all.
Most writers don't understand voice.
Most writers don't either. But readers are really like, I don't know why I love your book so much. And I'm just like, it's my author voice.
So this will be something only some people pick up because only some people learn to jazz or old rock and roll. But if you're having trouble understanding the concept of voice, think about the difference between any great guitar player and Jimi Hendrix. You can tell Hendrix if he's playing a single chord. There's 1,000 things that go into the way he plays the silence between the notes and the way he riffs the notes that's different from everybody else. And every really great guitarist or musician has that. You can tell a Louis Armstrong, the trumpet, he played trumpet solo. You can tell a Louis Armstrong trumpet solo regardless of what he's playing or whether you've heard it before, if you know his voice. That's what voice is. It's that total confluence of everything you are bursting out through your writing. Some people have a very well-developed voice, and some people have a very plain voice. And one of the differences I've noticed between the authors who have a fairly plain and hard-to-spot voice versus a fairly well-developed voice is timidity. There's a timidity that comes with trying to be too commercial in the wrong ways. Of course, it's very important not to be an artiste and really precious and never think about the commercial side of things. But it's also a mistake to try very, very hard to make yourself such an exact fit to slot yourself into a commercial niche that you fit perfectly and blend into the background. Your voice is what makes you you, no matter what you're writing. And unless you're writing media properties, it's what your audience comes for.
Yeah, and it's an amorphous thing to articulate, like you said, because it is kind of what makes you you. It's your lightness of touch or your breeziness. It's your use of comedy. It's the messaging that's in your themes that you explore consistently. You know, it's many things about you as a writer, some of which are entirely outside of your control, and some of which are ones that you can cultivate and change. And it is something to get back to sort of the original question. It is something to try to think about when you are reading something or experiencing something that particularly moves you in some or makes you laugh in some way or another, which is there a voice thing that's going on? What is it? Like, how would I, if I had to try to articulate voice, which is very hard to do, about my favorite author, what are some of those things? And you can kind of scattergram word cloud if you want to try and come up with voice, you know, and you can just be like, well, here's sort of structural elements, sentence structures, whatever. Here's, you know, sort of like emotional elements. Like, here are the things that reading this author makes me feel. Here's the way they write them. Here's the kind of stories they write. Here's the emotions that are engendered. You can sort of like just scattergram some words and be like, and try and figure it out, figure out what the draw is. But sometimes that cloud is entirely amorphous, and you may never understand.
And to tie it directly back to the original question, this is what influence looks like. You know how I talked about Monty Python earlier? Monty Python influenced directly Saturday Night Live, Fry and Laurie, and Douglas Adams. And you can see the influence and the fingerprints on each of them, but each of those three things are incredibly different from each other, because it's the Monty Python influence as well as everything else filtered through those artists. Those artists have all stolen from Monty Python, but none of them are plagiarizing them.
Yes, exactly.
All right, well, that wraps it up for this one. Thank you for sending it in, Art, and we will see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty McKeon and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners. Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.